This Tuesday's Clubhouse chat, Rob is going to be reviewing some of the top stories of the year and taking your questions. So feel free to tee them up. Just raise your hand. I want to let everyone know we will record so that we can make this available on our podcast platform. So, Rob, take it away.
Okay. So I was just mentioning that this is the time of year I typically sort of do a year end of year review where I look at what were the big stories of that year and how, and, you know, sort of wrapping up for that year, the big picture for that year and getting prepared for what's going to happen in the next year. So I thought it'd be interesting to talk about what were, you know, we're a few days away from the end of 2021. So what were the big stories of 2021. So let me, I'm just going to give you a brief overview to start the conversation, give you a brief overview of my countdown. And I just do a top five. So the, at number five, I have what I call the Great Leap Backward, which is the continued rise of authoritarianism and of dictatorship around the world. You can see that in the fact that we're all kind of concerned right now about the possibility, I think it's almost an inevitability, of a Russian invasion of Ukraine coming up by, you know, part of that, by the way, I came across a delightful little story of Vladimir Putin talking about his time during, after the fall of the Soviet Union. And he talks about how he was, you know, he had been a lieutenant colonel in the KGB, and he talks about how he was, you know, forced for a while to make ends meet to work as a cab, as a private driver, I think a sort of limo driver or a cab driver in Moscow. And you get the idea of what a, and he says, oh, it's not pleasant to talk about. So you get an idea of what a humiliation that would be for, you know, as a lieutenant colonel in the KGB, he was one of the elites, the nomenklatura, one of the people who was destined to be one of the rulers of the Soviet Empire. And here he was reduced to driving a cab. So you can see how he has this sort of, he's out for revenge for the fall of the Soviet Union and wants to put the old Russian Empire back together. And that's something people don't realize, is that the extent to which the Soviet Union was just Russian imperialism under the guise or the cover of a communist ideology. So he's trying to bring that back together. And also the big new development, the other big new development in this last year was the extent to which in China, you know, after 20, 30 years of sort of opening up the economy and having less dictatorship and a greater, you know, a very still limited degree of freedom politically, but much more than they used to have, China is basically being carried by Xi Jinping, is being carried back to a Maoist approach. So the over the summing of that big story was that I said, this is something I wrote fairly recently in a column for Discourse magazine. I said, it's been a while since the American system has faced a serious challenge from a global ideological rival. And that's going to be the problem that we're going to face. And I think it reminds me a lot of the Cold War in one other respect, which is that the nationalism of somebody like Vladimir Putin, I'm noticing it has a certain amount of sympathy among people here in the U.S. Now, back in the Cold War days, the Russians had sympathy on the left. These days, because they're nationalists in their ideology and religious in their ideology, they have sympathizers on the right. And Tucker Carlson has been going to bat for Vladimir Putin and the reasonableness of his claims in Ukraine. So that's another sort of deja vu that we're going to get out of that. Now, to go to the fourth one, is one I talked about here on Clubhouse a while back with everyone, and that is, I call it the anti-woke vote. And this is the year, so I sort of do a little overview in this, in the my longer overview for my newsletter. I sort of tried to do the whole sort of history of the current round of the culture wars, and I won't try to get into that now unless the discussion takes us that way. But it's really been going on, it sort of popped up in about 2014, is when this current wave of very intense culture war discussion, everybody being, you know, accusing you of being a racist and accusing you of being a sexist, and that sort of where the term woke started to be used as an everyday thing, that really goes back to about 2014, is where it sort of became dominant. And so we're now 7 years in on that, and I think what's happened is that anti-wokeness has been something of an intellectual or cultural cause for a while, but it has become in the last year more and more of a political cause and a popular political cause. And that was sort of heralded really by the election here in Virginia, where the governor, Democratic candidate for governor, was defeated because people were upset about a number of different things with the schools, but they were upset specifically about political indoctrination in the schools. And the idea that he was saying that, oh, parents shouldn't have any control over what gets taught in the schools. And so opposition to wokeness has become a political cause. Now, I point out that that's a nice new breakthrough, but it also creates some dangers because when it becomes a popular political cause, it becomes a bandwagon and everybody wants to jump onto it. And some people want to jump onto it because they believe in freedom of speech and not indoctrinating kids. And some people want to jump onto it opportunistically because they've got their own agenda they want to impose on people. So I talk a little bit about the potential problems that arise from it becoming a popular political cause. You know, politics is a highly parasitic field that whenever anybody sees something that's happening in politics, they want to grab a hold of it and profit from it and promote themselves with it and also push their own totally unrelated agenda onto it. So it's something you always have to watch out for. Number three in my countdown is the sort of second stage, the second year of the pandemic, and the what I sort of see as the bifurcation of the pandemic. So the interesting thing is early in the pandemic, the only measures that could be really taken against the spread of the virus were by their nature collective in a sense, which is that, you know, you had to have these measures be adopted sort of broadly by everyone for them to be effective. So you had to have a lot of people, and there was confusion about what was effective, but you had a lot of people practicing social distancing or using masks or doing one thing or another. They were, the pandemic was a collective phenomenon that you as an individual, there's a limited amount that you could do personally to protect yourself from it. And that the most effective things to prevent the spread of it were things you had to get everybody to do. Well, what happened this year is the decollectivization of the pandemic to some extent. And that is that with the development of effective vaccines, you could get a vaccine, you could protect yourself. And then the result of that is you sort of see the pandemic move into two tracks. There's the pandemic for the vaccinated, which has proven to be, because the vaccines are largely effective, it means that it's inconvenient for, if you're vaccinated, it's inconvenient. You may get sick, but you're much less likely to be hospitalized or to die. And that looks like the new Omicron variant is even a little milder, so your risks go down. Whereas there's a whole bunch of other people who there's a sort of a quarter of the population that basically totally refuses to be vaccinated. And they've gone about basically not just refusing vaccination, but to a large extent refusing any other measure against the pandemic. And they have been the ones who have been getting sick and dying in much larger numbers. So you've sort of seen this, and unfortunately, some of that goes along partisan lines. So you've sort of seen a partisan pandemic where you have people who, for ideological, political reasons, as I like to put it, they'd rather die than admit that they were wrong about politics. And so they just have dug in and will refuse to get the vaccine and are dying in much larger numbers and experiencing a much greater crisis. You know, Dave Barry, the comic writer from Florida, always does this very funny end of year review. And he summed it up very nicely. He says that this year there were a bunch of people who were vaccinated who went around acting as if they weren't vaccinated, and a bunch of people who weren't vaccinated who went around acting as if they were. And that's sort of how the pandemic has split apart in a second year. So unfortunately, I've been sort of beaten down to the grim policy that I've adopted of live and let die, which is, you know, instead of live and let live, hey, everybody can decide what they want to do. The more grim calculation here is, you know, those of us who get vaccinated and who take precautions, we're going to live, and we have to accept at some point that there's another group of people out there who won't take precautions, and we're really limited in how much we can force that on them. So it has to be live and let die, which also I hope has starts a Paul McCartney song, one of his better ones, going through your head. Then let's see. Number two in the pandemic, I'll just wrap up this little summary. Number two in the pandemic is the, how would I put it? The failure and incompetence of the Biden administration, which I hope was not a big surprise to anybody. I'm very critical about the former about President Trump, and we'll get to that as the number one story. But I had no illusions that Biden, the way I put it is, Biden was a guy who returned us to normal and put a normal politician back in charge, which seems like a great thing until you remember what normal politicians are like. And that's sort of basically been what has happened. And the big event is that his incompetence has manifested itself in a good way and a bad way. The bad way is the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which turned out to be a disaster, and I think is what is emboldening dictatorships like the dictatorship of China or this invasion of Ukraine. I think they're emboldened by what they saw with the withdrawal from Afghanistan, that it makes America look weak. It makes Biden in particular look weak and unable to protect American interests. So that's the bad aspect of his incompetence. The good aspect of his incompetence is that after a few early things he did, his legislative agenda has basically fallen apart. His giant, $3.9 trillion Build Back Better welfare state boondoggle is now dead in Congress. So it's the stalling out of his legislative agenda, which came partly from the fact that the agenda was badly designed in the first place, and also from the fact that he has not been an effective advocate for it. I mean, if you go and look at his record in the Senate, Joe Biden was never, a great legislator or a great competent leader. So I don't think we should expect anything different now. Now, number one, I think the story that really still overhangs the year is January 6th. It's the riot at the U.S. Capitol last January. Which I view as it was an attempt to overthrow the election results. It was an attempt to force Congress to not certify the results of a free and fair election. And I unfortunately, what's happened since then is that Trump and his supporters have doubled down on that. They will not give up the idea of the 2020 election being stolen. They will not give up the idea that. It's been coming out, the details that have been coming out of the congressional inquiries on this is that they had a whole plan to basically declare the election results last year null and void, and to have the pressure of the state legislatures in a couple of key states to change the election results in their state, which they don't really have the power to do, and then just simply declare Donald Trump the winner of the last election. That was their actual plan. There's lots of evidence about it now. And so I think this is, and the fact that they've gotten the Republican Party basically to sign on to this, and the most dangerous thing I've seen in the last year is the fact that the attempt to overturn the election between November and January of last year failed because the Republicans didn't have enough control over local election officials. And what I mean by that is the local election officials, even when they were Republicans, stood up and said, no, we can't do this. This isn't the proper procedure. I'm not going to go along. Well, over the last year, there have been efforts to target a lot of those local elections and local officials and elect people who would go along in defiance of the law, would go along to overturn the results of an election. So it's like they're making a preparation to steal future elections by actually getting the people put into the local offices who would support them to do that. And I think that's the most alarming thing that has happened this year. Because when you look about it, we talk about how America has a tradition of peaceful transition of power. Well, up until now, in 2021, we did not have a peaceful transition of power. We had a riot that was that invaded the U.S. Capitol and attempted to prevent the peaceful transition of power. And we've had lots of bigger threats before. Like I looked at Abraham Lincoln's first inaugural address, which he gave in March of 1861, after several of the Southern states had already officially declared their secession from the Union. And the whole thing is a big long plea to say, hey, let's not go to war over this. This is a really bad idea. Please, let's step back from the brink. which obviously didn't work. But even though that was under the shadow of secession, you know, the actual violence didn't occur until the next month. So this is the first time that you've had a transition of power that was accompanied by violence specifically directed to which got within a stone's throw, essentially, of actually disrupting the transfer of power. So that's, I think that has to be the, you know, 100 years from now, that's going to be the one thing people are going to remember about the year 2021. So I think that has to be the top of the list. So I'm curious what everybody else thinks would be their top stories or what they, their perspectives on those things. This incident. So sometimes the most important thing is something that didn't happen. So on that note, I want to say what I should have mentioned in talking about the pandemic is the really huge news. I guess it's the news of 2020, but it's also the news of 2021, is that for the first time ever, we've developed and deployed a vaccine during the middle of a pandemic. So typically what happens is, you know, it's an outbreak of a new disease. And by the time that you get around to going through to finding out how to make a vaccine and going testing it and getting it produced and et cetera, the initial outbreak has already run its course. And, you know, the vaccine's valuable because it prevents new outbreaks or reinfections and that sort of thing. But the initial devastation of the pandemic has already occurred. This is really the first time in history, to my knowledge, that we have developed and deployed a vaccine with such rapidity because of the technological advances that we were able to make it extremely widely available before the pandemic had run its natural course. And that's a huge advance. I think that's something that we need to sort of celebrate as one of the good stories, one of the piece of good news from the last year.
Yeah, and we are in dire need of good news. I'd also say that maybe a story that hasn't been covered and is less good news is, you know, we were hoping for a vaccine that would really function like a vaccine, that we would take it and we wouldn't get infected, we wouldn't spread the disease, and that, you know, is not turned out to be the case.
Okay, Jennifer, I have to say, I've been fighting this for months. You are completely wrong on that. This is how a vaccine functions. A vaccine is never meant to prevent infection. It's supposed to prime the immune system against the disease. And this one does that. It prevents infection in the sense of you are less likely to become infected and to become infectious to others if you have the vaccine. But the main thing is it is far, far, far less likely for you to become sick, to require hospitalization, to become seriously ill or to require hospitalization, or even less likely to die. So the idea that this is somehow not effective as a vaccine is based on an unrealistic and unscientific idea of what a vaccine is supposed to accomplish. If everybody were vaccinated, we would not be having, it would be the common cold.
I don't know if I agree with that. I mean, I've gotten my measles vaccines, my tetanus vaccines, various other vaccines. I'm not required to get a booster every 3 or 4 months in order to maintain their effectiveness.
Well, but the question is it is effective. I mean, that is the story. It is effective.
This was sold to us.
Complaining, like I said, the context for this historically is nobody has ever done this before. Nobody's ever developed a vaccine in the middle of a pandemic. So going around complaining, oh, but I have to get a booster, seems like, you know, it's like somebody gave me $1 million, but oh, I have to, I have to pay a 10% tax on it. Well, okay, but you're still up $900,000.
Right. And I agree that that for, you know, somebody who's in their 80s, for my parents, is a game changer. But for somebody in their 20s, in their 30s, in their 40s, the other thing is with your analysis is in just kind of separating, well, there are the unvaccinated, and this is now going to be, you know, that we, the vaccinated, will live and they, the unvaccinated, will die, without taking into account how many of the people who are forgoing vaccines have natural immunity. And
The vaccines actually give better, you have to go again, you have to look into, dig into the science of this. The vaccines give better immunity especially against Omicron and the newer variants. They give better immunity than having had the disease before. That's something that wasn't clear at first, of course, because, you know, the science works slowly. You can't get big, very firm results over, generally speaking, you can't get very firm results over a period of 2 to 3 months. You have to get them over 6 months or a year. Usually it works a lot slower than this.
But it's because so Omicron isn't as deadly.
The most recent figures are that the vaccine is actually better, especially for the newer variants. It is better immunity than natural immunity from having had COVID before,
If Omicron isn't deadly, and that's what it's been shown so far compared to the other variants, then that does whether it makes sense for, you know, these kids to get boosters when there are even warnings for 20 something males not to use it. So, you know, there can be more risk than just getting Omicron.
Well, that's something that, again, is still developing. So the early, I want to talk about this briefly. The early Omicron data came out of South Africa, and it was kind of hard to tell what that meant whether that applied anywhere elsewhere for two reasons. One is the average age in South Africa is something like 29. So these are people who are going to be more resilient against COVID to begin with, right? They're going to be younger and healthier and less likely to die. So if you don't see a big spike in deaths from Omicron, that might be part of the reason. The other reason is that South Africa has already had a large number of infections from previous variants, which confers some degree of natural immunity. So it was a little unclear what that meant. Now we're starting to get some early results from, I think, New York and London. I just saw that this morning, New York and London, indicating that as you see this now, the signature of Omicron is extremely infectious. It's like, basically somebody can give it to you just by looking at you funny. It's the signature of Omicron when it arrives somewhere is that the case numbers basically go vertical. It's this huge increase in transmission. So it's extremely transmissible. But usually what happens is you get a modest increase in hospitalizations and deaths. So it doesn't match what happened in the Delta wave, for example, which was a huge spike in hospitalizations and deaths. So what we were hoping for, the best outcome is that Omicron is way more infectious but less deadly. So it takes over from all the other variants, and it looked like it actually does that. It displaces all other variants, and then you have something that is more on the order of the seasonal flu, and that maybe what's happening. It's a little early to say, and I've been resisting taking an over-optimistic interpretation of it, because one of the things that will also happen is that the average flu season is less deadly than it would normally be because the flu's been around a lot. You know, this is actually the current flu that we get, the seasonal flu, is actually the 1918 flu, the Spanish flu, as it developed into, you know, less deadly variants. And hopefully that's where we're going now. But the thing is, part of the reason the Spanish flu doesn't kill a lot of people every year is, well, because older people do take precautions, and also because it's been out there for 100 years. Most of us have been exposed to one variant or another of it at some point. So that gives us some small degree of natural immunity, whereas the coronavirus or COVID is still fairly new in the population. There's still a large reserve of people who have never gotten it. So I want to put the caution there that even if Omicron is less deadly, something that's less deadly but infects a very, very, very large number of people will still kill a lot of people in absolute numbers. So people have to remember that. But the hope here, and it's, again, I don't get over optimistic, but it's a possibility, is that you get a much more infectious but less deadly variant, and it becomes much easier to live with. But you're still seeing hospitalizations and deaths spike in a number of places. I'm seeing them in Wisconsin. We're seeing them in where I am in Minnesota. It's been happening partly because of the Delta variant, and I think it hasn't changed. That hasn't gotten any better with the Omicron. So I'm just going to say, we're going to have to wait a little while to see what the results are, and not just go with the thing that we hope was going to happen.
Hellwolf, welcome. Do you want to unmute yourself? Hi. There you go.
Hi, everyone. I just want to mention one thing that I found it quite enlightening regarding vaccine, right? I just wanted to chip in. I listened to lately Joe Rogan's interview with Peter McClough. I found that quite enlightening. Obviously, I don't know too much about it, but I find that 2.5 hour interview quite enlightening. That's all I'll share. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, we've had some interesting guests, including Scott Atlas, on our weekly webinar, and you may want to check that out as well. Dale, I see you with your hand raised, and sent you an invite. There we go. So excited.
Okay. Well, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. This okay. guy has kept himself very safe throughout the pandemic. So we'll take one of whatever you're having.
Okay. I think that one of the big stories that we're not talking about, which of course this is not really an area for philosophy, but it's a huge story, which is the highly negative real interest rates and the 13 years of our Federal Reserve basically intervening in the bond market and just kind of holding the house of cards up. And it's kind of showing now with the inflation rates that we have. And it's a huge problem. It's going to be huge for us going forward, especially if we, you know, have an entanglement, a military entanglement, which will really force us to be spending more money that we don't have.
Yeah, there's been this whole school of thought, especially the modern monetary theory and among the Democrats, about how, well, look, we can just spend a trillion and spend another trillion and spend more trillions because, hey, we just print the money at the Federal Reserve and it's no problem. And of course, we're starting to see the results of that. I also want to say we're starting to see the results of it because we didn't start doing it now. We've been doing it continuously, as Dale points out, over a long period of time. And, part of the problem is the response to the pandemic was, oh, no problem. People can all stay home and stay home from their jobs because we'll just pay them money. And we'll just, spend trillions of dollars out of federal money out to people. And that'll be no problem. And we're really starting to see that show up. And the biggest thing about it is the thing that terrifies me about inflation, and I don't make it the story of one of the stories of this year. I think it's the story that's building this year, and it could well be a big story for next year and beyond, is the fact that, the way I put this is, the more people try to reassure me about inflation, the less reassured I become, which is that the more they reassure me and say, oh, don't worry about inflation, it's not really happening, it's temporary, it's no big deal. We can go ahead and keep spending this money. That's not really causing the problem. The more they tell me that, the more I think nobody's worried about inflation and therefore nobody's going to do anything about it. And that makes me even more terrified that the problem is going to get much, much worse before people finally decide we have to stop this. I think, I'm of the generation that's just old enough to remember the 1970s and remember inflation, double-digit inflation the last time we had it. And my part of what's going on here is I think there's a whole generation that doesn't remember that takes this sort of mild 3% a year inflation that kind of chips away at your money but doesn't really devalue it rapidly. They've taken that for granted as just the way things work. And I think they're going to have a rough wake-up call to see what life is really like when you have 9, 10, 12% inflation. Hopefully it doesn't get worse.
I think could be, underappreciated this year and coming to a head in 2022.
Well, okay. And one thing I do want to say is that the negative stories tend to predominate. If it bleeds, it leads. And the bad things that are happening tend to take up most of our attention. So I want to say there's a couple of good things I've been seeing that one of it is simply the continuing. It's one that you don't really notice every year because it's been happening year over year for a long time. But somebody called it this year the biggest. I've quoted it from an article somebody else wrote, the biggest and most important story in the world. And that is the continuing decline of global poverty. And that is the idea that capitalism and science and technology that was developed in the West has continued spreading. It's, you know, long ago it spread, decades ago it spread to Asia and made, you know, and the Chinese became wealthier and the South Koreans became wealthier, became one of the, you know, basically a first world level of prosperity. And that's been spreading throughout the whole world. And the number of people in absolute poverty has been decreasing by basically like millions a day for the last couple of decades. So it's one of those headlines that because it's happening every day, decade over decade, you don't really notice it, but it's an enormously positive story. So that's one thing that I need to think we need to always keep in our minds that's always happening in the background is this amazingly positive thing. And it's not just positive from the perspective of people are less poor, which is, you know, good enough as it is, but it's also for the fact that, you know, as Jennifer knows, the spread of ideas and the spread of free market ideas, the awareness of Ayn Rand's ideas, all these things have also spread out around the world and become much more sort of widely available and widely known. And that is part of what's driving that or supporting that progress against global poverty and the spread of science and technology and industrialism around the world. The other thing I would take as a, I don't know if it's going to be a good story or a bad story, but one that I sort of take as an interesting thing to watch and one that I'm working on a lot is the fact that we have had sort of a stable set of ideological coalitions in the United States really since the 1950s, since the emergence of modern conservatism in the 1950s, where you had the, you know, fusion of the free marketers and the religious conservatives and the foreign policy hawks all sort of joining together to form an ideological coalition, of which objectivists were sort of welcomed more or less happily as a part, more or less happy on the conservatives' part and more or less happy on our part. And then on the left, you had a certain coalition, a sort of a pro-welfare state coalition that was often divided amongst itself on whether to be anti-communist or not. But the one of the things I see happening with the rise of wokeness in the last 7 years or so is the way in which, I talked recently at Clubhouse about the rise of nationalism on the right and the rise of wokeness on the left, and it's sort of creating splinters within both of those ideological coalitions, that you have a growing number of people, sort of old-fashioned 20th century liberals, the kind who would have been anti-communism in the mid 20th century. Those people who are rebelling against and objecting to the conformity and lack of intellectual freedom being pushed by the woke people. And at the same time, you also have this split between the nationalists and the libertarian, more quote-unquote libertarian end of the right. And I think it creates the possibility that, you know, these long ideological coalitions that last for 50 years, they last so long that everybody takes them for granted, those might be breaking apart and forming some interesting new combinations. That's just something I want to really watch. It may happen in the next year, it may not. It may happen in a good way, it may happen in a bad way. I mean, I've always been personally in terror of the fact of the idea that some of the sort of far authoritarian people in the authoritarian conservative types will discover how much they have in common with the people, some of the people on the left and vice versa, and that they'll actually start working together. And that would be a very ominous development. So hopefully we can get though some of the more pro-freedom people on the left and pro-freedom people on the right to work together more.
That's a great point. I want to recognize also some other people who are in the room. We have Professor Stephen Hicks, who is the leading expert on postmodernism. He's also a senior scholar at the Atlas Society. And Jay LaPere, who is chairman of the board of the Atlas Society. So, Jay, you missed. Dale asked his first question. Gave his own top story of the year. So we'd love to get others' thoughts on what their top stories of the year should be. Roger.
Yeah, so I just wanted to respond to what Rob's saying in terms of some of the concerns that come from the right in terms of the rise of nationalism. Is there any way that you can conceive of that we could perhaps educate those circles that their fear of globalization and running and hunkering down into this nationalism perspective is not necessarily the opposite of the globalization movement that they oppose, and that really localization and getting into, you know, the smallest governments that we can form and societies that we can form, and that nationalism is really has more in common with globalism than I think they might realize, and that if they really wanted to beat off the movement towards the types of fears that they have, that really embracing really rejecting altruism completely and embracing individualism, which would pull them more into that libertarian state of mind and start thinking more locally. Is there any way that you can think of framing these conversations? Because we have them a lot on Clubhouse and off of the app. But it seems to be the problem that I've observed is that there's a fear, and then there's a response to that fear, and that response doesn't seem to be logical. And I'm just wondering if you can maybe spell out a scenario in which we can maybe help center those conversations on getting people back to an embracement of Enlightenment era ideals and the idea of individual liberty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's sort of the whole game in a way is to take people have, how would you put it? Fears is one way of putting it. Sometimes the fears are rational, but some of them are rational. And, you know, it's the whole problem that Ayn Rand dealt with in The Fountainhead, where she says, she gives to Ezra Tui this speech where he talks about how, we give you poisonous food and poisonous antidote, that, you know, that he gives you an anti-individualist creed on the left, and then as the answer to that gives you an anti-individualist creed on the right. Now, I think Tui and I'm sure Ayn Rand was talking not about that less in an American context than in a European context, where, you know, you had just seen, I mean, at the time she was writing this, you know, it was within a decade that you'd seen the Nazis in Germany. So, you know, as time she was writing it, the Nazis were in power, and in the late 20s and early 30s, they had sold themselves to everyone as the answer to these communists. Oh, this terrible communist threat in Germany. You have to answer that. The original version of Antifa was, I mean, you know, the current guys, the college kids who dress in black throw rocks at the police and call themselves Antifa, they took that name from Antifascista Action, which was the sort of militant street brawling wing of one of the German Communist Parties, the Stalinist German Communist Party. And so the original Antifa had its original Proud Boys, eventually became the Nazis. So this idea of selling you, you know, you have a certain bogeyman of the communists, and then you sell them something that is almost exactly the same ideology, just with different uniforms and a different shaped mustache. And you sell them that as the alternative. And so that's been the whole game all along, is how do you offer this other alternative to show people that, look, all the things you're afraid about or the things you're dissatisfied with, here's a different and better and more fundamental answer to that. And that has basically just been, I don't see now as being a fundamentally different situation. The details change. And so I think, for example, in the last, you know, since 2014, the culture war issue has become much bigger. And so you have to sell people on the idea that, look, we have a third alternative in the culture wars, that it's not embrace, you know, religious obscurantism versus embrace the latest fads on the left, on the woke left, that you have a pro-reason alternative, a pro-individual alternative. So the biggest problem that we have as objectivists is the fact that there's a small number of us. So if people look out into the culture and say, well, what are the things being offered to us they're going to look to the big movements, and they're going to see, I think, unfortunately, right now, the nationalist conservatives, they are sort of a fad. They're benefiting from sort of a lot of publicity right now. And so people look out and they're going to see them. And these people are very loud and they're very strident. And they're going to gravitate towards that. And so to some extent, I think we have to think about ourselves as going to young people on the right, people who are repulsed by the left, and saying, look, this is the real alternative. What they're selling you is not the real alternative. I don't know of a special way of doing it, but I think we have to adapt to the special circumstances of today.
Is there any hope, Rob, for objectivists to bite the bullet and help the LP, the Libertarian Party? I know that Rand wasn't really a big fan, but in terms of saving a group that does fancy itself to be individual, it's been hijacked by Rothbardians, and I think that Randians would at least be able to steer the ship in a more sensical direction.
Yeah, and that's a great question. The odd thing, so I've been part of these libertarian wars, you know, the objectivists versus libertarians thing since, you know, 1986 or 80, probably 87 or 88. But so I've seen this develop over a very long period of time, because, you know, that was much closer to the inception of the Libertarian Party than we are today, with many more decades have gone past. So I think it's curious how the Libertarian Party actually worked out in practice. And I think the selling point to the libertarians was, we're going to be a bigger big tent, you know, not just you objectivists will only accept people who agree with you on all these little details about art and psychology and all that. We're not going to do that. We're going to be a bigger tent. We're going to reach out and get a wider audience. And that's true to some extent. But what happened to the Libertarian Party is they became, at least in my experience, is they actually over time, they became more obsessed with purity and with, well, you're not a real libertarian if. And so you had these things where you had some, you know, I think one of the debates they had where they're trying to choose a candidate to run for president. And they were picking, they had some fairly mainstream figures that would have wider appeal who were running, and they got in trouble because they thought because they weren't against license plates or something like that. You know, driver's license. Do you remember this detail?
Yeah, it was Gary Johnson said he thought it's not a bad idea to have proper credentials to drive, and he got booed off the stage.
Right. So this is like this tiny little inside baseball, irrelevant, I call it Libertarian Debate Club, right? And Libertarian Debate Club isn't always necessarily a bad thing, because there are questions like, how would you fund a free society without any coercive taxation, that are worth looking at, and there are interesting things to be said about it. But at the same time, you also have to recognize this is not a current political issue, and is not going to be a current political issue probably within my lifetime. So it's kind of a theoretical thing. That's why I call it Debate Club. And so they take these little Libertarian Debate Club issues, like maybe we should not have driver's licenses, and they would make that like a major issue in the campaign that somebody like Gary Johnson would have to jump over. And I think that's part of the problem with libertarians. I mean, I have had the experience of having libertarians tell me I'm not libertarian enough because I'm too locked in foreign policy. So that's the problem, is I think they sort of got themselves to the point where they were so oriented towards the inside of their own movement and policing the purity of their own movement that they haven't spent enough time actually building that big tent they were supposed to build.
Thank you. So I have a question regarding Afghanistan, which I think is something of note for this year, perhaps not the biggest news of the year, but something worthy of note and sort of where we look forward when it comes to American foreign policy based on that situation. Do you see this as a sign that America might stop being so interventionist, be more conservative where we send troops, keep them more home? Or do you think there'll be a resurgence where we start sending more and more troops overseas in the coming years?
I sort of call it 20th century light, which is that we're sort of reliving the history of the 20th century in miniature. And if that's true, then the way I designate the current era is that it's the 1970s. right? And you think about it, the 1970s, we have retreat and withdrawal in a war overseas. You have inflation. You have a sort of a Jimmy Carter type. I think Joe Biden is a pretty good sort of resurrection of Jimmy Carter, although he has the distinction of having already been in politics when Jimmy Carter was in office. So he's been around so long, it's like everything old is new again. So you have a lot of parallels to the 1970s and this general funk of defeatism and self-doubt. I mean, the whole racial politics of the era is sort of a rehash of the blame America first, internal criticism kind of politics of the 1970s. And I suppose maybe some of the, you can build up the parallels as far as you'd like to go. And if that's the case, then we're sort of waiting for Reagan to come along, or we're waiting for the turn back to the right, which actually happened a little before Reagan. It happened in the late 70s with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan was part of it, that we started, the American people sort of got tired of losing and tired of feeling like, everything was going downhill and we were in retreat, and got behind a more, I would say, more American self-esteem is the way I would put it. I think that is, what we're seeing now, even with the nationalist right, what they're trying to ride on is that there's a sort of a sense of people want to have America be proud of itself again. They want to have America be great again, quote unquote. But specifically not just be great again, but be proud of itself again, and to have self-esteem and to assert itself again, and to have the sense that, hey, we're on the rise and we're doing great things. Now, oftentimes when they turn to the nationalists, they turn to the people who do not have the answer for how to do that. What they have is an answer of, okay, let's withdraw more into ourselves, and let's withdraw, let's hunker down more, and go back to, religious traditionalism, and they have the wrong answers for how to make America be proud and self-assertive again. But I think that the desire for that is there. And it's there in some places that the left is going to be very surprised by, because one of the things that happened, it came out in the election in Virginia, and I think it's coming out other places, is that Hispanic immigrants and the rank and file Black voter is way more pro-American and way more pro-prosperity and wanting us to be great and to be proud of America again. They're way more in favor of that than the far left woke types who claim to speak for them. So I think there's this great reason, and it's in a way that reminds me of the Reagan Democrats, right? These were the sort of blue collar factory workers, often union members, who the left thought, the Democrats thought, these guys are for us all the way. We can take their votes for granted. And they all voted for Reagan in 1980 because they wanted America, because they were patriots and they wanted America to be growing and prosperous and proud of itself again. So I think we have the sort of setup for that sort of Reagan constituency. Unfortunately, I don't see any Reagans on the scene. And I think that's sort of the problem that we have right now, is that I think we are going to, let's put it this way. If you look, people say, this sort of assertive American assertiveness in the world, sending troops overseas, there's never going to be the public support for that again. But then you look at Joe Biden's poll numbers for this year, and you see that when in August, when we're in the middle of the, as people are watching their televisions, the news from Afghanistan, he goes from being about 5 points positive, 55, 45 approval rating in the polls, doing pretty well. He crashes down and he hasn't really recovered since then. So it's also clear that America constantly retreating and being on the losing end of everything is also not very popular. And I think that, if you have a Russian invasion of Ukraine, and if you have a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, which is another big, who knows, it might happen story for next year, that if you see the dictatorship sort of marching forward the way they did in the 70s, marching forward and we're always falling back, people are going to say, wait a minute, we need, now not to say they're going to say we need to send troops somewhere, but we need a more assertive policy the way that we did under Reagan in the 80s.
Rob, so do you think that Biden's current low approval rating, first of all, are you surprised by it? And do you attribute it primarily to this kind of shock of what happened in Afghanistan and then just an inability to recover?
I attribute it to the fact that he's Joe Biden. This is a guy who lost his previous two presidential campaigns, like blew up on the launch pad. I think the last time he ran for president, he ended his campaign before the year in which he was going to be running. I think he ran, it was in 2008 that he was going to run, and he ended his campaign in like December of 2007. So he's just not that great a politician. He got elected. And again, I'm going to draw from the fountainhead here. There's a point at which Peter Keating asked Ellsworth Tui, how come I'm not the new big thing anymore? How come I'm not on the top anymore? And Tui tells him, you should ask yourself, why were you ever there in the first place? Right? Joe Biden is sort of, I've compared him there's another line Ayn Rand had about I think it was Wesley Mouch being the meeting point, the zero at the meeting point of opposing forces. And I think that's a really good example of what Joe Biden is. He's the guy who got elected basically because everybody else was more unacceptable than him. And there was nothing particularly great or good or talented about him to begin with. He's a mediocre, glad-handing machine politician from Delaware. So I think it really comes from the fact that his popularity has declined because people realize people discovered again that, oh yeah, this is Joe Biden. And he's never been that popular a person. Now, it also comes from the fact that he's had to preside over a couple he has presided over a couple of notable failures. And it's that drumbeat. I think it's a combination of Afghanistan and then the supply chain crisis and inflation. I think inflation, as it became clear that this wasn't just something we were making up, that it was really happening, I think that gave people a lot of, the economy is relatively good, but people know that inflation makes a good economy seem much worse than it really is. And so, and it's sort of a warning bell. People see that as like, when inflation is returning, that means we're going back to the 70s, it's going to get bad again. So I think it's those two things. And it's really going to be a matter of, if his legislative agenda stalls out and nothing really horribly bad happens for the next year, he could improve. But as he's going to be because he's the zero at the meeting point of opposing forces, he's going to be kind of at the mercy of events and at the mercy of, does the other political, when you look forward to 2024, if he's still alive and kicking, he's, one of the oldest presidents we've had. When you get there, it's going to be a matter of, is the other party shooting itself in the foot even more than yours is, which is how he got elected last year, in 2020. That's how we got elected. The other party shot itself in the foot more than he did, and he got in. So it's really, because he's a zero at the meeting point of opposing forces, he's very much at the mercy of outside events. And that's my sort of sum up of who Joe Biden is.
So less a question of the policies that his administration is pursuing and just his kind of lack of appeal.
His lack of appeal, and also the fact that his policies are always going to be the product of whatever he perceives as the political forces on him at any given moment. Like the reason he spent half this year trying to push this giant big government boondoggle thing that the American people really didn't want. The reason he did that is because he was trying to appease the far left wing of his party. They wanted the goods. They wanted the goodies after they got help to get him elected. And he felt the need to, okay, I got to tack left. And I think, the best thing that could happen to him is if being the man in the middle, the sort of compromising politician par excellence, if he sees this sort of anti-woke vote and decides, okay, it's better for me to tack right and to do more things to appease throw the woke kids and the far progressive types under the bus. But I'm not sure he's going to be smart enough to do that. I mean, he's never, and I say that and people think, oh yeah, he's senile. And my question on that has always been, how could you tell? Joe Biden has always been like this. He has a long track record of opening his mouth and saying foolish and saying foolish or incomprehensible things and making bad decisions. So I can think about, here's how things could go well for him. But you also, he's a guy who just is not making great calculations about anything. He's not a political manipulator who makes clever calculations. He's just a guy going with his sense of what are the forces, outside forces on him, and how can he appease those. And that generally is not a theory of leadership that works out terribly well.
Too bad for him, I guess. Too bad for the country as well, because historically he was more of a moderate and seen as kind of a centrist within his party, or even further on the right of his party. So, well, thank you, Rob. This has been great. We have just a few more days left to the year. I want to thank everybody for joining us today. And I want to let you guys know tomorrow at 2 p.m. my time, 5 p.m. East Coast time, I'm going to be having a webinar discussion with Howie Rich on term limits. We're going to be back on Clubhouse on Thursday with a different kind of chat, not with one of our scholars, but I hope they will join us. We're going to be talking to somebody who's been on the front lines in Australia fighting some of the more repressive interventions in that country. And then next week, Rob is back. We'll be talking about enlightened self-interest, so tacking more philosophical. And then on Wednesday of next week, talking to a woman, Kara Damsky. She wrote The Abolition of Sex, How the Transgender Agenda Harms Women and Girls, something that I had not previously known much about, found the topic very confusing. And that also might be a brewing story for next year. It's kind of a subset of the backlash against woke that Rob has identified in terms of how the inclusion of male athletes in women's sports teams or in women's facilities might be something that people are not quite ready for or haven't evaluated, possibly some of the negative unintended consequences. So thanks, everyone, and see you later in the week.